So, Professor David Finney, I'm very glad to be here at your home in Edinburgh to interview you on behalf of the James Lind Library. My name is Jan van den Broeke. I'm one of the editors of the James Lind Library. The purpose of the interview with you is to talk about the history of all your work about adverse effects. Adverse effects of drugs. This work of yours has been so important that your collected writings have been republished by the Uppsala Monitoring Center, the WHO Center on Adverse Effects of Drugs. These are dozens of writings. But it all started somewhere, and what most people in this field do not know is that you had already a long career as a biostatistician before you entered the field of adverse drug effects. So tell me something about how did you start to study statistics? Did you come from a family where there was a lot of...
No, I certainly did not. I began my education in Cheshire, where I was brought up, and in my school days I was a good mathematician.
Yes.
And eventually, in 1934, I was able, with the help of a small scholarship, to go to Clare College, Cambridge, in order to study for a degree in mathematics.
Was there a math gene in your family?
I think so. I think my father definitely had mathematical talent.
Yes.
Though he was taken from school too early.
Yes.
I mean, way back in the late 19th century. He never had any higher education himself.
Okay.
Well, no academic history in mm-hmm. my family at all, on either side.
Yeah. But then, you just told me a moment ago, he worked as an accountant?
He was an accountant, yes. Yes.
And he was interested in mathematics, and he learned you about it.
He was certainly helpful to me.
Yes.
He was always willing to spend hours on trying to help me through with a problem that I didn't understand.
Okay.
But his own mathematics was a very limited extent.
Yes. But still, so you became very good in mathematics at school and you got a scholarship at Cambridge.
Yes.
To study statistics.
No, to study mathematics.
To study mathematics, yes.
No, my university studies were entirely in mathematics, which in Cambridge at that time involved some mathematical physics, or traditional dynamics, hydrostatics, and things
yes.
of that kind, but no statistics up to my first degree.
Uh-huh. And who was the leading person at that time that you were studying with?
Eminent Cambridge mathematicians of the period.
Yes.
Well, the best known would be G.H. Hardy, who
okay.
was a leading pure mathematician of that
yes.
period. And I attended some of his lectures.
Yes.
And attended lectures by other eminent mathematicians of the time, whose names I have difficulty in reproducing today.
Okay. But at a certain point, you turned to statistics. How did that come about?
At a certain point, I turned to statistics because I had a spell of illness. I need not go into details. It was the common fate of many young men at that time to have fears of tuberculosis.
Yes.
And I had a scare of that. And I then, unfortunately, acquired a dose of typhoid fever, which caused me to miss a substantial part of one university term. And these changes led to me beginning to study statistics as an extra subject.
Yes.
And I began to find this very fascinating because John Wishart, who was the leading professional statistician in Cambridge at that time, in the mid-1930s, had an attachment to the School of Agriculture, and his lecturing on statistics was very much influenced by the needs of agricultural research for experimental design and for the interpretation of experiments in the field, but always very strongly emphasis on the mathematical content.
Yes.
But then, a year after graduating, I was fortunate enough to obtain a scholarship from the Ministry of Agriculture, which took me to work in the department of the late Sir Ronald Fisher.
Yes.
In University College, in the Galton Laboratory, University College London.
And what was he like to work with?
One never knew what was coming next.
Okay.
But a most inspiring person to work with.
Yes.
He had, as is well known, a sharp temper, but if one could evade that, he was an extraordinarily helpful man, and I had the privilege of working closely with him on some of his interests of the time, notably in connection with human genetic linkage,
okay,
about which I wrote a whole series of papers. And I also was able to assist some other students. I remember particularly he had an Indian cotton geneticist working in his department for a year or two. And I was able to assist this man interpreting Fisher's scrawled notes after he'd had a session with the master.
Yes. Good. So you helped this Indian statistician in interpreting what were the ideas of Fisher's about his
yes.
data.
Yes, he would have a session with Fisher.
Yes.
As a result, he came out of that often with two or three pages of
yes.
scrawled notes that Fisher had made.
Okay.
He'd come to me afterwards and said, hey, could I help him interpret these?
Okay. And what was your purpose at the time with these several papers? Did you want to do a doctoral thesis? Well, or?
Yes, I was assuming that I would eventually put these papers together and complete the series for a PhD.
On genetic linkage?
On genetic linkage, yes. But I rejoice in the fact that in those days a PhD was not regarded as the essential feature for the young scientist as it is today.
Yes.
But because my own progress in that direction was interrupted because suddenly in the course of my first year with Fisher I was offered a post in the statistics department at Rothamsted Experimental Station, which was then the home of the most advanced work in applied statistics.
And who offered you that post?
This was Frank Yates.
Yes.
Another distinguished statistician of the period, himself very much a disciple of Fisher's.
Yes.
Who had succeeded to Fisher's own work at Rothamsted.
Yeah.
So in 1939, I moved to become assistant statistician at Rothamsted. There I stayed, in fact, until 1945.
And what kind of work did you do there?
Primarily superintending the work of analysis of field experiments.
Okay.
Consultation on the design of experiments,
yes,
and other miscellaneous topics. Yes, I did a lot of work with the insecticides department, becoming interested in the statistical analysis of tests of insecticides by spraying samples of unwanted flies. This led me to the interest in what became known as probit analysis. On which I did not in fact do anything very original myself, but because nobody else had done so, I wrote a book about it.
It was a very useful book at the time.
It was certainly a useful book. This was my first major publication in 1946. Because by that time, quite large numbers of biologists in various fields were needing to use this statistical technique and found it rather difficult. Rather to my surprise, the Cambridge Press has this year reissued the first edition of this book.
It has. Your publications keep to be reprinted. The book and your papers on adverse effects and other things.
Why they should have done this, I really don't know. The book today is of nothing but historical interest. The methods that I described with great care have been totally superseded by the ease with which everything can be done on a modern computer.
But the conceptual basis was there. But so you stayed at Rothamsted until 1945?
Yes.
And what happened then?
1945, I was invited to a lectureship in Oxford. The research and teaching in biology at that time in Oxford was expanding considerably. And biologists were increasingly aware that they needed the help of statisticians. So I think they insisted in the university councils that they must have some statistician appointed with special mission to teach and to be available for consultation by many different types of biologists. From forestry, biochemistry, genetics, and sundry other special fields.
So what was your title?
My title was lecturer in the design and analysis of scientific experiment.
That's a good title.
It's a good title, yes.
For a lectureship. And so what were some of the topics you were then consulting about or working about?
Well, I was becoming particularly interested in biological assay, and in fact I became involved quite a bit with Professor Byrne of the Department of Pharmacology.
So you learned about drugs, medical drugs?
I became increasingly interested in fields of drugs. Though
not the adverse effects.
Nobody thought about adverse effects at that time. Drugs were good, that was that. But I did have some involvement with the medical school.
About drug assays, about pharmacology.
I can't remember very well today exactly what, but I know I was involved as an examiner for a PhD of one medical student of the period, a man who later became Vice-Chancellor of the University of Edinburgh. That was long ago. He died, alas.
But so bioassays of drugs were one of the main things you have been working on at Oxford.
I think that is so. Though I also did a lot of work with the forestry department.
So you continued some interest in agriculture and forestry.
Yes. and of course these were the early days of penicillin and other antibiotics. Yes. And I became involved with that, with some work of penicillin assay. Yes. And that kind of thing.
Okay, so that was with Florey's department.
Yes. And I think I may have been responsible for almost the final publication of any new table of logarithms.
Okay.
Someone, I can't remember, was biochemist or physiologist, wanted a table of logarithms to base 2.
Yeah.
And so I got to work, and I had a computing assistant.
Yes.
Who was able to transform more readily available tables of logarithms to base 10 and produce logarithms to base 2.
So you did that without a computer, but with a computing assistant?
It was done on electromechanical calculators.
Okay.
Easy enough.
Yes.
But, oh yes, there was also an entirely different genetical problem that a colleague put to me that exercised a lot of computing time then. In 1949, I was invited to visit the USA to teach at a summer school.
Yes.
In the very powerful Department of Statistics in the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
Uh-huh.
And that proved an important visit for me, because I had choice of what I would try to teach.
Yes.
I chose to teach a general course on biological assay.
Okay.
And looking at my notes afterwards, I decided that here was material for a textbook.
Yes.
And so a year or two later, I was able to produce my major textbook on biological assay. But the other event of that year was that on the voyage home, one didn't fly the Atlantic in those days. Americans find it difficult to believe nowadays that there was a period when if you wanted to cross the Atlantic, you came on a boat.
Yes.
Why didn't you fly?
Okay.
But on the voyage home, I met a charming young lady on her first trip from North America to the old world.
Okay.
We took a liking to one another, and I was married to Betty in the following spring.
Okay, in the most romantic of fashions. In the most romantic of fashions, you met on a transatlantic boat. Okay.
And still in Oxford, I was, as I say, married in 1950.
Yes.
And then in 1952, the Food and Agriculture Organization of United Nations in Rome invited me to go and spend a year in India visiting their agricultural statistics unit in New Delhi, working in fact with the Indian student whom I had come to know very well in my year with Fisher in London before the war. So.
And that was an interesting year.
Certainly an interesting year. We went with some trepidation because we had to take with us our firstborn child, a little girl who was about 6 months old when we went to India. And fortunately, it did her no harm. She was never mauled by a tiger.
Okay. No diseases, especially?
No diseases beyond the ordinary happenings of childhood.
Exactly. Yeah.
And Betty and I were able to travel around quite a bit in India.
Yeah.
Still in the wonderful days when one could visit Kashmir.
Okay.
Most beautiful part of the world that I've ever been in.
Yes. You've been back several times.
I've been back several times.
You took a great liking to the country.
Yes, because the report that, well, Frank Yates was also involved in this, and the report that he and I wrote on the needs of India for statistics in agriculture,
yes,
led to the establishment of the Indian Institute of Agricultural Research Statistics,
uh-huh,
which, having consisted at the time we were there, essentially of five or six people,
yes,
has now celebrated, I think, its 25th anniversary.
Yes.
Maybe 50th anniversary, and has a total staff of several hundred. But I have been back there several times for brief periods as a consultant, just short visit to a week or two. I'm very much in love with India. It's a wonderful country.
Okay, so that was early 1950s, your first visit, and you were still at Oxford at that time?
Yes.
Okay, did you stay at Oxford? You left Oxford at a certain point.
No, left Oxford in 54.
54.
Yes. We came back from India in 1953, and then, quite out of the blue, in late 1953, I was asked to consider a move to Aberdeen, again with emphasis on agriculture.
Yes.
And that the several then important agricultural research institutes in Scotland were really in need of more statistical assistance,
yeah,
than they could have access to at that time. And by agreement with the University of Aberdeen, I was brought in as head of a small university department,
yes,
with additional staff,
mm-hmm,
as an agricultural research council unit of statistics,
mm-hmm,
to provide services to agricultural research institutes in Scotland. That, as I say, was in 1954, and there I stayed until 1966.
In 1962 you did your major second setup.
Yes.
What happened in 1962?
In 1962, yes, mustn't miss that out, I went back to spend a year in the USA, in Harvard.
Yes. What was your purpose?
My purpose was that the Department of Statistics in Harvard, which was then run, in fact, by people whom I had met from earlier visits.
Yes.
And Fred Mosteller, who was, I think, at that time the head of the department, was on leave.
Yes.
And there was some funds available for employing us a substitute for a year.
Yes.
And since my wife had not revisited her own country since our marriage 10-12 years earlier,
okay,
we and our children were now of an age where we could travel with them without too much disturbance.
Yes.
So we moved to Harvard for the year 62-63.
Okay.
But it so happened, and this is now the vital point, that the Department of Statistics, for reasons now totally unknown to me, could not find me working space within their own walls. They arranged with the Department of Preventive Medicine that I could have a desk and a share of a room in that medical department. A department that had fairly strong statistical interests of its own.
Yes.
And after arriving there, I had an early talk with the head of that department, Professor Dave Rutstein.
Yes.
And one of the first things he said to me was that he thought it would be a good idea if I spent some time looking into this thalidomide tragedy and considering what contribution statisticians might make towards predicting future dangers of similar kind and preventing such tragedies occurring again.
Yeah. Had you heard of it?
This was totally new to me, because although I assume that the British press must in the preceding months have had some references to this, I'm not a reader of every paragraph in my newspapers, and I hadn't seen any mention of this developing tragedy. But Rutstein said he thought I ought to spend some time thinking about it, and he gave me one or two references to some of the first papers that had been published suggesting that the responsible agent was thalidomide taken early in pregnancy.
Yeah.
And what could be done towards detecting this happening again with other drugs? My immediate reaction, I'm sure, was to say nothing can be done. This is not a statistical problem. There are no data on which a statistician can work. But I began to think about this, and I had begun to realise what I have always regarded as a statistical responsibility, that if there are data, find the best way of making use of them. If there are not data on a particular topic, try to collect data that will be helpful.
Yes.
It may not be good, pure mathematical statistics of the kind on which I was brought up years earlier, but what evidence exists must be used somehow.
Yes.
And the outcome of this was that I prepared a report that I showed to Rutstein, who, I think to my surprise, thought there was some useful stuff in it, suggested I should tidy it up a little and distribute it widely to ministers of health in different countries.
Yes.
I think my first reaction to this was a little presumptuous to send them this document, but after a little further thought and editing, a definitive copy of this report was prepared and was mailed around the world to ministers of health in London, in other countries, in Washington, and not least to the World Health Organization.
So, and that was, and this was eventually published as your 1963 paper.
Eventually became my major paper.
And then was worked out into the 1965 paper, your major paper about the design and logic of a monitor of drug use.
Yes.
That major paper. So by that accidental, say, encounter with Rutstein and that problem, you wrote this essay in its preliminary form, and this was widely distributed. And what happened next?
What happened next?
You returned to the UK, to Scotland.
Returned to Scotland, to Aberdeen still, in the late summer of 1963.
Yes.
And, well, two important things happened, that somehow or other, WHO had received this report, and it had come into the hands of one of their senior medical officers, a man named Hans Halbach, a German pharmacologist, who had been told that that as a result of the last General Assembly of WHO, he had been chosen to to take steps on behalf of WHO,
yes,
to protect against similar incidents in the future.
Okay.
And by chance, there had been available for him to look at this report,
yeah,
by an unknown Englishman,
yes,
who obviously knew not much about medicine,
mm-hmm,
but there might be something useful in it.
Yes.
And Halbach got in touch with me and suggested that we should meet if possible. Mm-hmm. I have an idea that I was going to Switzerland on other business around that time.
Yeah.
But I certainly did visit Halbach in Geneva, had, yes, a useful talk, and he was clearly very grateful to locate someone,
yeah,
who had thought about this as an intellectual problem,
yes,
to which no solution existed, uh-huh, in textbooks of medicine or of statistics.
Okay.
It might not be a very, very, very good solution that was offered, but at least it was something to get to work on.
So that was one track, and we will come back to that in a moment, but similar things also happened in the UK.
Yes.
What happened in the UK?
In the UK, again, as you say, Jan, somewhat similar, that the Ministry of Health in London was very properly concerned about what they should be doing for future protection. And they had picked on Professor Sir Derek Dunlop,
yeah,
of the University of Edinburgh.
And what was he?
He was a professor of therapeutics.
Yes.
A man of considerable eminence in his own profession. Not a name that was known to me at the time.
Yeah.
But he had been requested to accumulate a committee on safety of drugs.
Yes.
That would discuss suitable lines of action.
Yes.
And again, my report came into his hands.
Yes.
And he'd seen the need for a subcommittee of his main committee, a subcommittee on adverse reactions.
Yes.
And he wrote to me saying, would I be so kind as mm-hmm. to become a member of this subcommittee? And so this began a second series of frequent meetings.
Yes.
Because WHO went ahead with several meetings and intensive working parties in Geneva. Many entertaining stories I could tell about some of these meetings, but I became very impressed with the internal workings of WHO.
Yes.
The enthusiasm, notably of their support staff, the mm-hmm. secretarial staff, the hard work they would put in,
yeah,
in support of meetings.
We'll come back to that. And then in London, you witnessed or you watched the birth of the yellow card system. How did that come about?
Ah, yes.
Because you were looking for systems.
Yes. I have difficulty in saying exactly how it came about. I think Bill Inman, in his autobiography, has quite a bit to say on that.
Yes.
Because he was the real inventor of the yellow card.
Yes.
But I think that before he came in to the Committee on Safety of Drugs, I think we had been encouraging physicians to report any suspicions,
yes,
that a patient had suffered an adverse reaction to a prescribed drug.
So, and that idea did not exist before. I mean, that was an idea of your committee. Let's start encouraging physicians,
yes,
to report.
I don't know what would have happened before. Well, I suppose, yes, before that, if Dr. X in Northampton had thought that the patient he saw last mm-hmm. week had suffered an adverse reaction, he would have written a letter to the BMJ.
Yes.
I don't think any other, I'm fairly certain, no other centralised mechanism existed.
Yes.
But doctors did begin informing the Committee on Safety of Drugs.
And what years was that? This was 1960.
This would be
1964.
Yes. I imagine I attended my first meeting of the Adverse Reactions Subcommittee. I would think probably in early 1964.
Okay. And so what did you do at these committees?
I was very insistent that these records should be put onto some system of computer filing.
Okay.
Because this was the early days of computing.
Yes.
Long before a computer could be found on every scientist's desk.
Mm-hmm.
We had great difficulty. I made a nuisance of myself in being so insistent. I think we got the use of a computer in the Ministry of Agriculture. Mm-hmm. that could occasionally give some time to input of these records and to producing line printer output of large tabulations showing what had been reported in the most recent period.
Yes.
I can remember at our regular monthly meetings we used to receive as committee papers large batches of this line printer output.
Yeah.
And we would discuss whether there was evidence accumulating on any particular drug and any specific reaction. But initially, the Committee on Safety of Drugs, although the main committee was well supplied with medical expertise, it was not until the appointment of Bill Inman, date of which I couldn't tell you without referring to his autobiography, that when he came in, he immediately became enthusiastic for improving things.
Yeah.
And it was clear that there was beginning to be the growth of concern about any publicizing or undesirable release of personal information about patients.
Yes.
And also it was clear that doctors were not going to report their suspicions of adverse reactions unless provided with a simple routine way of doing this.
Very easy system, yes.
And so the outcome of that was that Inman devised this yellow card with the notion that every registered physician should have a supply of these cards with no postage to pay on them, just to seal and put in the nearest letterbox and find their way to the committee.
Yes.
And also that they would preserve the anonymity of the patient.
Yeah. And the idea was, as you said a moment ago, the accumulation of suspicion.
Yes.
It was not to prove something, but if several independent doctors remarked the same thing, there was suspicion accumulating.
Yes. It would have been delightful if there had been just a simple piece of statistical computing that could be undertaken on all these data. Turning up a large star saying there is significant evidence that this drug is dangerous.
Yes.
But no, it was accumulating suspicion, which of course very much needed informing by medical experience, where Bill Inman, as a good physician, was invaluable, and one or two other members of the committee were very useful.
Yes.
Whereas I was totally a learner.
Yeah.
I mean, I inevitably began learning much more medical jargon and terminology that I'd ever heard
originally
before.
Coming from agriculture, of course,
yes.
Was a major move. This yellow card system idea and the system itself was then copied all over the world.
Something similar.
Yes.
I can't recall ever having seen the actual machinery
yes.
for any other country.
Okay.
You would know yourself, of course.
They were also yellow in other countries.
Oh, were they?
Yes.
Well, yellow, of course, has long been a good signal for the plague.
Yes. Okay. And that's where WHO comes in again. Because
yes.
In all countries or in all major countries, systems had been put in place after the 1960s, end of the 1960s,
yes.
early 1970s, where doctors could spontaneously report. So now WHO comes in again.
Well, of course, a whole series of meetings and working parties had been set in motion.
Yes.
Arising from my first meeting with Halbach.
Uh-huh.
And these took place mostly in Geneva,
yes.
intensive 3 or 4 day sessions. But as you say, the similar schemes were being developed in other countries.
Yes.
And the working parties were usually doing their best to insist that this information should be fed into a central registry
mm-hmm. yes.
under the direct management of WHO.
Yes. Because why? Because the problem was international? Did you see the problem as international?
The problem was international, yes.
Yes.
If evidence accumulated against a particular drug in Britain,
yes.
it was at least desirable
mm-hmm.
that the French should know of it.
Yes.
Or the Germans, mm-hmm. or even the Netherlanders.
And similar evidence might be accumulating also in other countries.
Yes.
Yeah.
But one did sense a little national jealousies about records.
Yes.
That some countries were hesitant about allowing their individual records to be gathered into a WHO pool.
Yes.
As I say, we had many meetings discussing this,
yes.
and
did they want to?
There was a central office,
yes.
In fact, set up in near Washington for a time.
Okay.
Yes, because FDA made some facilities available,
mm-hmm.
and.
But then people starting looking for a place for the centralized accumulation of all this information.
Yeah, yes.
It could not be in Geneva, apparently, for some reason.
For some reason, WHO was not prepared to have this entirely as an in-house operation.
Okay.
They say FDA made funds and facilities available
mm-hmm.
in an office in near just outside Washington for,
yes.
for 2 or 3 years.
Yes.
This wasn't all that satisfactory.
Uh-huh.
Eventually, one member of our working parties, Orca Liljestrand,
yes.
who was professor of some form of medicine, therapeutic medicine
mm-hmm.
in Uppsala, said that he thought he could persuade the Swedish government to make facilities available
yes.
at minimal cost
uh-huh.
in Uppsala.
Okay.
And there was also a lot of encouragement from Barbara Westerholm,
mm-hmm.
again another Swede who had been very active in our Geneva meetings and cooperated closely with Bill Inman.
Yes.
On developing of dictionaries of drugs and dictionaries of adverse reactions, kind of structures required for any systematic reporting,
yeah.
so that things could be classified easily.
So this led to the establishment of what is now the Uppsala Monitoring Center, which is WHO Collaborating Center for International Drug Monitoring.
Yes.
That's how it all started.
That started there.
And these are the people that recently reprinted all your publications about pharmacovigilance, adverse drug reactions, and things like that. But apart from the yellow card system, already in your earliest publications, you also insisted that there should be other systems of, say, systematic collection of all events.
Yes.
And you outlined that you could start either with events, collect all events of a particular type, or with the drugs, and then collect all the events after the drugs were given, or with a particular batch of patients, and then collect all drugs and everything that happened afterwards.
Mm.
So you greatly insisted that besides the voluntary reporting, there should be systematic efforts. And that also led to new developments, amongst others by Bill Inman.
Yes.
Tell us more about that.
Not quite sure what more I can
tell
about
that. The prescription event monitoring, for example.
I was personally very, very insistent that there should be a good operational terminology.
Yes.
I think I was probably the first to introduce the word event.
Yes. And why was that important?
Largely because
this
was a standard general term in use in mathematical probability theory.
Yes.
Nothing whatsoever to do with drugs.
Okay.
But mathematicians and probabilists
love
discussing intervals between events.
Yes.
Or counting the number of events in which a coin falls heads or tails.
Yes.
That kind of thing. The word event was well established there.
Yes.
And I doubt whether it was ever used in a medical context before it became adopted as the standard term for the situation that is being reported on adverse reactions.
Yes, because an event is anything that happens to a patient, meaning untoward thing, anything that you don't want to happen.
Yes.
Whether or not you think it's related to the drug.
Well, of course, an adverse event.
Yes.
Anything adverse happening to the patient.
Yes.
Which...
You insisted that all events should be collected, not only the suspected events or the things that people might think about, but everything else.
Yes, anything unusual.
Anything unusual, yes. And this led to, for example, Bill Inman setting up the prescription event monitoring.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, there, of course, the idea was that the data would be a little more trustworthy if efforts were made when a new drug is released to follow a large block of prescriptions and make special inquiry as to whether any event...
And then record any event after the prescription.
Yes.
Okay. And to that... One could add control groups, people with other prescriptions.
Right.
So the system became more formalized than the spontaneous reporting.
Yes.
And the same happened, if I'm not mistaken, with the Boston Collaborative Drug Surveillance. They also did something similar.
I think so, yes. I quite forget the details of that now.
Yes.
But this prescription event monitoring was certainly an attempt to plan ahead for accumulation of data that would be recorded with reasonable objectivity.
Yes.
And would strengthen the inference on causation.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. But always in my mind with the thought that once a suspicion is aroused, there's need for a return to laboratory research thinking on what is the channel of causation.
The mechanism, yes.
The mechanism.
Okay. And you also said one of the possibilities was to start with groups of patients and record every prescription and every event.
Yes.
Which is these days, nowadays, this is the most common type of what is now called pharmacoepidemiology linkage. That people have, say, a batch of records from an insurance or from another party, and then they have all prescriptions, but also all events, meaning all hospitalizations or all consultations, so that whenever there is a suspicion, they can go back to these data.
Yes.
Yeah. To your judgment, when I read the old literature of the early 1960s, 1970s, the idea was that these systems would help in detecting new things. My impression is that they mainly help in confirming. Mm-hmm. Once a suspicion is raised, then something like prescription event monitoring or linkage of records helps confirming. That they have not detected themselves, meaning the systems themselves have not detected so very much. It's mainly the astute doctor who has the suspicion, that's still the major source of new ideas. That's my impression, but I would like to have your view.
Well, just remember, I've been out of this for a long time now.
Okay.
So I'm not really qualified to speak about what is most commonly happening today.
Yes.
But I certainly don't disagree with you.
Okay. Good. You also insist in several of your papers about independence from the pharmaceutical industry.
Well, that is something that Bill Inman was always very insistent on. You see, again, you've read his autobiography.
Yes.
You realize how eventually he got rather wearied of his situation with Medicines Commission or whatever it had become.
Yes. Yeah,
I've been out so long I don't even know the correct name.
Okay, never mind. They change every decade, the names.
I was always sorry when the Committee on Safety of Drugs changed its name.
Yeah.
But, as you say, each new government wants to have a new system of naming of things. But Bill grew very tired of this, and then rather suddenly resigned, because he had major health problems, and he sought support for an independent drug research unit.
Yes.
Which in its early years I was very much involved.
Yes. Which was prescription event monitoring,
which he did
in Southampton.
Yes.
Yes.
And that, of course, still exists.
Yes.
And as far as I know, flourishes.
Yes.
And again, I have no connections with it today.
No.
I think they've done a good job with prescription event monitoring. I have no idea what comparable work goes on in any other country.
No. Well, there is a similar system in New Zealand also.
Yes.
Yes.
Oh, yes. Yes, of course, New Zealand did contribute some pioneering work with yes. one or two very valuable people.
Yes. Okay. If we go back to the history now, there are two last questions I want to ask you about the history. And that is, you conceptualized so very wonderfully in your papers, 1963, 1965, and then there's one later paper in the early 1970s. You conceptualized the problems so very well and the outlines of the possible solutions of data collection. What in your previous career might have helped you? Because your previous career was, as you told, in genetics, in bioassay, in agriculture. Were there ideas that somehow fertilized, helped you in creating these ideas about pharmacovigilance?
I think probably my background as a mathematician.
Okay.
That mathematicians like to introduce to new concepts.
Yes.
And to have language mm-hmm. that is exact enough for describing them.
Yes. So indeed, you wanted to be very precise in your description and to be almost mathematical in thinking about the relationships between several events being the prescription and possible outcomes. Okay. Then my second and last question to you is the significance of the thalidomide affair. I'm asking this because there was an FDA before the thalidomide. The FDA already existed for decades. And there had been other incidents before, like in 1937, there had been a tainted batch of sulfonamide. It was which caused several deaths. This was a major episode of adverse reactions to a drug in 1937, which led to legislation and regulation in the United States. There have been other things like the Cutter incident, the batch of polio vaccines that proved out to give poliomyelitis. So before thalidomide, there had been things and there had been institutions, but after thalidomide, there was a change in the outlook of people. What happened?
I think this is a psychological question, really.
Maybe.
But I would suspect it was the emotional impact of the thalidomide cases.
Yes.
I think to some people, some of the other incidents mm-hmm. you mentioned,
yes,
well established in the history of medicine,
yes,
but deplorable, but
yes,
some people died quickly and that was that,
yes,
whereas thalidomide mm-hmm. created these extraordinary malformations,
yes,
with people still around suffering for their whole lives from
yes.
them. I think
you see what I mean is the following. These earlier incidents, they never led to people trying to set up systems to prevent this.
No.
While thalidomide led several people, I mean, you talked with Rothstein when you arrived in Harvard in 1962, asked you, we should be thinking about systems. And when I talk with other people who have pioneered the field, I always get this same idea also in the histories of the committees in several countries. It always starts with thalidomide and then we want to set up systems. So my question is really, why never before? Because before there were also incidents. Why didn't they think about setting up incidents before? And why did this idea of setting up systems and being formal about it and being obsessive and aggressive in monitoring adverse effects, why did they start with thalidomide and not earlier? Might have to do in part with the psychology of the thing, yes.
I think that's a very difficult question.
I know. That's why it's my last question.
I think it can only be that the previous effects had not been sufficiently dramatic to cause public concern.
I see.
You mentioned, the polio inoculation.
Yes.
Or the sulfonamides.
Yes.
Both new things.
Mm-hmm.
Did people in its essence, say, we introduce something new? There are bound to be occasions when things go wrong.
Yes.
But in these incidents, what went wrong was that sadly some people died rather speedily.
Yes.
They weren't around suffering for a long time.
Okay.
Or being seen around the place as deformed in any way.
Yes.
Whereas I think the thalidomide cases had much greater dramatic impact.
Okay.
I have never actually met a thalidomide child. Have you?
No.
Now, just over a year ago, I attended a meeting in Uppsala.
Yes.
Commemorating some anniversary for the Uppsala Monitoring Centre. I was invited as a figure from the past to attend this meeting. I found a most impressive occasion.
Yes.
With representatives of, I think, about 40 or 50 different countries.
Yes.
All of which are regular contributors of information to the Monitoring Centre, many people giving very short contributions to discussion, and all tremendously enthusiastic about the work they are doing. I mean, not merely the obvious highly developed countries, but little bits of tropical Africa that nobody had ever heard of 50 years ago.
Okay.
And yet doing this with, I had the impression, with great care for doing the best possible, in spite of this being something added on top of their real duties as local Ministry of Health officers.
Okay. With that note, I would like to end the interview and to thank you very, very much for giving us this insight into...
It's been a pleasure to meet you. I've thoroughly enjoyed every moment of going over these bits of the past.
That's good. Thank you.